Hi, I'm Mickey Lowe.
Hi, I'm Bishop Todd. And welcome to the C4SO podcast.
Well, welcome back, everybody, to your weekly dose of Mickey Lowe and Bishop Todd. It's great to be here with you all today. Bishop Todd, how's it going?
Doing well, thank you.
We are especially thrilled this week because we get to kick off a new little series, don't we, Bishop Todd? Why don't you tell our listeners what our new series is?
Yeah, this is a series that features some of our church planters and talks about some church planting theory and some church planting practicality. And we get to remember together how core church planting is to God's calling on C4SO.
Yes. And today we have the privilege of sitting down with Brad Swope, who is the canon for church planting. And he is currently pastoring Roseville Horizon Church. He's, I think, a professor, too. So Brad kind of does it all. And yet he is so generous with his time to sit with us to talk about church planting and meet with us planters.
Nothing good happens without leadership. Mm. And Brad has really brought a lot of good needed leadership to the planting of C4SO churches, because in the beginning, it was all happening just kind of organically and naturally. And as we grew, we needed somebody to give it some focus. And so I'm always super grateful for Brad and proud of the work that you guys do together.
Yes, we are grateful for Brad. He is truly just generous with his wisdom, his gifts, his time. So please enjoy this awesome conversation with Brad Swope. Well, Brad Swope, it is a pleasure to have you on the show. You are a hero of sorts, at least to us and to all of the church planters in the cohort. So it is a privilege to have you in front of us now. Welcome to the show.
Well, it's just great to be with you, Mickey.
Yeah, so, you know, man, myth, living legend, Brad Swope, absolutely. Right here on the C4SO podcast.
That may be the first time anyone's ever used that phrase about me.
There you go.
Well, it won't be the last, that's for sure. So we need to know some really important things about you first, Brad, before we get into the, you know, deeply spiritual stuff. We want to know, what is like a most embarrassing story during your time as a church planter? I know like we have a ton of stories of weird things, strange encounters.
Like an icebreaker.
Yeah. So tell us about a moment.
If I ever write a book, one of the books I want to write is, you know, you've planted a church when ...
Yeah.
So, and then you ask 1,000 church planters and they all tell you this story. But I could tell you about the guy that showed up to help. We didn't know that was in a purple gorilla costume. I won't tell you that story. But I will tell you that we had a really hard time finding musicians at the very beginning. And so we were renting musicians to come in and help us out. Mm-hmm. And we had a guy and it was just horrid. And it was so bad that I couldn't be in the room. I was outside talking to some of my team as they were leading worship. And I heard that he'd strummed his last chord, and I was supposed to close in prayer, and I was about 50 yards away, and I had to literally sprint into the room and breathlessly close in prayer. So,
that may be one of the worst.
It was really painful at all levels.
Yeah. So, yeah. I get that.
Yeah.
Oof. Okay. Especially as a worship leader, Mickey gets that.
Yeah.
He was bringing out the like 70s praise hymns, and it was just painful to be in the room. So,
you know, sometimes they're done right, but there's a very, very thin line.
That's a chapter in your book, Brad.
Yeah.
The day I left my own church plant.
Yeah. The threshold for corny is pretty low.
Yeah.
I could tell you about the offering that were the total of $20. Uh-huh. And so we literally took that $20 and went out to McDonald's with my team afterwards and got like $1 McDonald's hamburgers. We used all $20 on that.
That's a feast. Yeah.
You planted a church when you've gotten a $20 offering. That's the line.
Yeah. It totally happens. So now that we've heard a little bit of, you know, these embarrassing stories, what is something that you're really good at that our listeners would be surprised to hear?
Yeah. So of course I'm prepped for this question because I've listened to the podcast and I've been, I've asked myself that question. How would I answer this?
Yeah.
Obscurely, I'm really good at like catching things. So like I was an athlete. So like if something falls off like a cabinet or I can catch it before it hits the ground. So like I have cat-like reflexes.
Can you catch flies?
I actually can catch flies.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So you got crazy hand-eye coordination.
Yeah, literally, I learned that at basketball camp. You just sweep over the top of them, you catch them, shake them up, and you throw them on the ground to disorient them. So
yeah,
can't relate. I don't have that skill. That's amazing.
That skill has not translated to being a pastor yet, but I still have that.
Maybe. There's still time.
Yeah, there could be the day where something falls off the table or something, and you grab it.
Something crucial.
Yeah.
So, Brad, all of our listeners would know you in your current role, but not many of them would know your faith journey. Let our listeners know a bit about how you came to faith and your initial growth in faith.
Yeah. So my dad was a pastor. I grew up as a PK. I'm still in counseling for that, by the way.
Of course,
third of three and knew all the nomenclature and really was not a person of faith and knew I was not a person of faith, yet put on the role as a PK because I was expected to dress and look a certain way. Mm-hmm. Ended up even going to a Christian college. I went to Wheaton. You had to write an essay as to how you came to Christ to get into Wheaton. I wrote an essay that would have made you cry.
So we knew right then you're bound to be a fiction writer.
Yeah. But I'll tell you, even at a place like Wheaton, right, I found my flock of lots of folks just like me. No real sense of faith.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until my third year, actually, I had the choice of going back and working construction in the summer after my parents moved to Connecticut in a place where I didn't know anybody, or going on a mission trip to Hawaii with YWAM. And I chose the YWAM, and I ironically came to faith on that trip.
Wow.
It was definitely altering the trajectory of my life from that moment on. So it was pretty cool. I had always carried a fair bit of shame that if I ever had to tell my parents that I'd acted like a Christian all those years. But it was one of the greatest joys to come back and tell my parents that I'd come to faith over that summer.
That's very cool.
So tell us a little bit about kind of Bishop Todd's role in your faith journey, because you guys go way back. You have a long connection. Tell us about how you met Todd and tell us the history.
I was thinking about this, Todd. I think it's been 31 or 32 years since I was an intern in Virginia Beach under you.
Sounds about right. All I know is you didn't have gray hair. Well, I probably didn't either.
No. Yeah, we both looked a lot different. But you had gone out to Virginia Beach to kind of save a dying church. And a friend of mine went out to be your youth pastor, Ray Huff. And Ray invited me. I didn't actually know you at that point, to come out and help start a college ministry. And you and I had a brief interaction. And I moved out and was your intern for about 6 months before you got called back to the Vineyard in Anaheim to be the national director.
Right.
My own journey took me back to work at a church in Palm Desert under Kevin Springer.
Yeah.
This was a time in the Vineyard where there was a real church planting culture that I think you helped create. And there was lots of people in their 20s and early 30s dreaming about planting churches. Mm-hmm. I can remember being one of like 75 to 100 of these guys and just hungry to be kind of equipped and then sent out. And that was one of the things I think you did best, Todd, in your role in the Vineyard, was really send out a whole flock of church planters, just a young church planters. You started Young Leaders Network and you started putting us in rooms with really interesting people like Dallas and Stan Grenz and Nancy Murphy and even Brian McLaren in terms of reading the culture. And that was really formative for us. And so after a couple of years with Kevin, about 4 years, I actually went out and planted amongst a group of young guys like me in Sacramento. You and I have kept close tabs on each other ever since then, even though right after that you left that role. But you and I have kind of worked together. I brought Todd up to speak at the university that I teach at, and we did some conferences together. We've had a lot of fun over the years. I've always considered Todd as a mentor and a really trustworthy leader. And, you know, we see the vacuum of trustworthy leaders in this culture. So I've held on to Todd like grim death because I love to be
inspired. That's so sad. And thank you.
So let's talk a little bit about Anglicanism. What kind of led you, what drew you to this tradition, and kind of how did you end up even becoming an Anglican priest?
Yeah, it's actually predates you, Todd. I don't know if you know this, but my wife is Dutch. But before that, I was at Wheaton when Robert Weber was at Wheaton and wrote the Canterbury Trail book and was already in those chapel services, leading basically liturgical services and really creating an imagination. And that was a stirring, I think, over evangelicalism. Those were the early roots of really evangelical church turning towards a tradition I have found in my own journey that evangelicalism, while really formative to me, at some points is so disconnected from church history that it's a mile wide and inch deep. And I think a lot of times you feel very, you just don't feel rooted. And so even in my own journey, there was a time as I was pastoring this church that I'm like, man, I need to be resourced with something deeper than just, you know, chords that of songs that have a good riff and a hook and, you know, everybody's singing and, you know, sermon series. I don't know. So my wife being Dutch and being traveling in Europe quite a bit, I would always find myself in these cathedrals and Anglican churches and beautiful places and just one to it. And then my own kind of version of deconstruction, as I said, is leading me to look for more resources as a pastor. And then, Todd's journey really influenced me. I was there at Todd's consecration as a priest and then as a bishop, and that seeing the three streams come together just really be, I'll never forget your bishop when you were consecrated as a bishop.
Yeah.
Just the beauty of the ceremony. And then I think, who did you have? The guy from Saddleback? You have Rick Warren.
Rick Warren preached, yeah.
And then you had Dallas Willard, I think. You were so spoiled.
Wow, yeah. Seriously,
I don't know if you even know that. But I was there for those things, and it was deeply formative. And that's led me on my own journey to search out and then to really desire to be a part of that tradition.
Yeah. So you had been around the ethos of church planting, as you say, in the Vineyard. And then in 1999, you started what at the time would have been, did you call it Roseville Vineyard or?
It was Horizon Church.
Horizon Church. Okay. So as you look back now over what's now 24 years, what are the experiences of your own that you find yourself calling on as you coach our church planters?
I think about every church plant is a miracle. Mm-hmm. And it really can't be plotted on a graph or a piece of paper. You will not find a time in history or a culture or a people group where church planting is not the most effective way of discipling people and doing evangelism. You just won't find it. Mm-hmm. It defies the odds. And this is the deceptive thing. I think a church plant always, always, always should aim for the unchurched, dechurched, the folks who are not in church. And you'll get other people come towards you. God will give you folks that will help you do that. But I find too many church plants thinking about just how to become a church and make themselves attractive to Christians oftentimes. And I think church plants always, always, always have to aim for folks who have no church expression. Yeah. So that was our goal. We planted kind of, the other book I had always thought about writing was In the Shadow of Giants, because there were some mammoth mega churches just around us. And we were this little dwarf little church. And so we just gave them a game. We can't compete. So why don't we go find people that are not in church? So the first 100 adults that we tracked this for a while, first 100, when we met them, 85 of them had no church expression. We literally established ourselves in one of the two Starbucks in Roseville at the time and had every meeting. And there was a point within the first year of our church plant that every barista had come to some church event. And I ended up marrying a lot of them and dedicating a lot of them and baptizing a lot of them. And the church just kind of grew with us in that regard. A lot of those folks we really poured into, and we just kind of grew the church from that standpoint.
Brad, I want your opinion on a couple, maybe two sides of one coin. Is what would you say are some of the unique challenges of church planting as opposed to doing ministry in an established church? Obviously, there are massive differences. What are some of the unique opportunities that church planting offers to communities?
Well, when you plant a church, there is no institution and there's no institutional support, right? Mm-hmm. Everything is being started from scratch. And one of the hardest things is to build critical mass. Yeah. And there's a real vulnerability in those earliest days. Like, we were on a Zoom call last night with all the church plants, and some of the people talked about getting that text, hey, I need to have a talk. Just unnerving, because you don't, that are they leaving the church? Are they challenging something? Like, and you feel it in your bones, like, you're missing one person, you feel like, oh, this is going to bring the whole ship down. We can't afford to lose that. Some of the challenges is just that feeling of vulnerability and the difficulty of making connections and networking and kind of getting established in that regard. But you're on the razor's edge of faith, and you're taking this kingdom risk, and God always shows up. It's mm-hmm. it's every church plant I've ever known is a one-off, and you couldn't have plotted it and you couldn't have predicted it. But then every church plant sees miracles. Every church plant sees things happen that would not have happened had they not just taken that risk. And there's something quite beautiful about establishing a new worshiping community, even though, you know, we come from a long and deep tradition and there's lots of structure to that tradition. There's, you know, the fact of the matter is they're all different and they all have to do with the people that God's called together in that time and place. And it's a beautiful expression, a unique one-off in history, nothing like it before or since. So I think the opportunity is to see God do something brand new, and it builds your faith even as you're extending like the gospel message and people are coming to faith at the same time.
Yeah, it's definitely the scariest thing I think I've ever done that Travis and I have ever done. It is absolutely terrifying, but I feel like the Lord has done work within us in this process. And I like the way you phrased it. You're at kind of like the razor's edge. That's exactly what it feels like. It's so easy to say, yes, I trust in the Lord and I have faith in him. But when you're kind of standing on the edge of, hey, I'm about to jump off of this, I like really, really need to trust that God is going to carry us. And you're right. He always does show up, and he shows up in ways that you just don't imagine.
One of the sadnesses of becoming an institution is you lose a little of that. It's different when a church is sitting on $200,000 in the bank because they have a rainy day fund. It's quite different than when you have $200 in the bank.
When you have nothing.
It's just like, it's a completely different thing. But looking back now after 25, I miss some of those taking risks for the kingdom. It's kind of a different game. We still do, of course. We still are doing it all the time, but it's not quite the same in those first couple of years of what it's like to really take a risk. And then like, oh my gosh, God did it. God showed up. I needed him so desperately. And then he did it. So it does build your faith, doesn't it, Mickey?
It really, really does. And I think we try, you know, with the folks at our church, we try to be really honest about those things. And when God does show up in miraculous ways, no matter how big or small, we try to kind of ingrain that into our DNA so that we never forget God's faithfulness. So
capturing those stories, early stories too, and telling those stories, because it's a faith builder for everybody.
So you touched on this a little bit, Brad, but speaking of tradition and kind of a longstanding history, what would you say are some of the distinctives of church planting within an Anglican context specifically?
There's a breadth and depth to the tradition that I actually think helps us do discipleship in a much deeper way than I think I was equipped to do when I was sent out. I mean, we never want to separate evangelism from discipleship. We're not supposed to make converts, we're supposed to make disciples. And I think our tradition does that. But like, there's a sacramental ontology that comes with our theology within our tradition that I think is like incarnational ministry comes a little bit more naturally. We really believe God is present where we're at. But I think there's a parish mentality that comes that I think is kind of lost on the church. I think something within evangelicalism and the church growth movement where we were allowed to kind of adopt, oh, we're all supposed to be these regional churches and not be located to place. I think we lose something. So like, we moved our church, we bought a building. It was a small building embedded into a neighborhood about 7 years ago. We just were looking yesterday at our staff meeting, and I think we have 25 families now that are within 1 mile of the church, and about half of them walk to church. And
that's so cool.
If your church was suddenly whisked off the ground from a tornado and never to return, would your neighborhood miss you? Are you good for the neighborhood? Or are they just see cars driving by and nobody knows it, and they're parking in your parking lot? And I believe our communion gives us a sense of parish and place that's, I think, really important. Yeah. And I would hope all of our church plants really say, I'm here, God's placed us here. How do we take on the problems of this neighborhood? How do I meet my neighbors? Yeah. How do I become like weaved into the story of this neighborhood? I think that comes with our tradition as well.
How is the culture of church planting changed over the years since you last planted? And maybe what are some of the methods or innovations that have been utilized in the last recent years, right? So I'm approaching church planting right now, but obviously it was different 20 years ago, 30 years ago. What are some of the changes and what are some of the things that you feel like kind of innovate this movement of planting?
There are some things that are exactly the same. So there's the power of the gospel. There's the need for Jesus. There's the need for community. That Acts 2 model, nothing has changed. When I was an executive pastor at Kevin Springer's church, I had to lead a campaign called This Phone's For You, which was a telemarketing campaign, which actually worked. It doubled the size of our church. So I can't imagine doing that today. There was a time when you would set up your A-frame sign and people would come to your building. And I think we all would recognize that Christianity culturally no longer dictates the terms of the discussion. We're in a post-Christian, post-denomination, post-modern world. Like I always think about, remember we used to have those church signs and we had announced our sermon, you know, sermon series questions people ask. They're not asking those questions, nor are they looking to the church to answer those questions. In fact, they've lost faith in the church to have any reasonable answer. In fact, I think we would say at some level, the culture we've seen where, you know, becoming a Christian makes you a worse kind of person. And I think that's a real challenge, except for if you're committed to incarnational life on life ministry, because when you're actually in neighborhoods and you're doing life on life and you're doing the real work of not just selling people on Christianity, but investing in people and opening up your lives. Well, then there's a legitimacy to the words. So it's like, I think we might've said, you know, even when we planted, maybe the world's heard enough of us speaking and maybe they need to see us living in a certain way. And then maybe that'll give us merit to our words a little bit. Well, I think that's as true. So like, is it really true that Jesus makes a real difference in a person's life? Not inauthentically, not painted on smile and plastic Christianity and authenticity, but like, how is he really meeting you? Like I have a spiritual director and his name's Trevor Hudson. And he always asks the question, how is Jesus meeting you in your desolation? How's he bringing you consolation? Well, that, there's a lot of people who are experiencing a lot of desolation. So if we can model how Jesus meets us in the midst of our desolation, not act like we don't have it. Now we have a gift to give. Well, that only happens life on life a little bit. So in some ways, I think the game has changed in that our, I don't know, there's still that mega church thing, but I think it's appealing most to Christians, the big show and the fog machines. But I think the business we want to be in has to be incarnational. And I think that's ahistoric. I think that works in every time and every culture. So I don't know, Todd, I'd be interested in your answer on that.
No, I think you're right. The principles are the same. Like if you think gospel, that's the same. If you think of human need, that's the same. Although those needs get expressed in different ways in different times and places and spaces. Ecclesiology is the same. Mission is the same. I think the challenges are, you know, in a sense, cultural, and we have therefore the need for adaptive means. But I just think when I started my first church in 1979, I mean, Christians were on the cover of magazines and Christianity was cool and the Jesus movement and if nothing else, Jesus music and the early forms of Jesus music worship. So it was a bit like starting a McDonald's compared to, as Brad said, this postmodern, post-Christendom world we live in. You know, people wanted Calvary Chapels because it was cool, or in the Vineyard, people wanted Vineyards because Vineyard music was cool and the kind of things that were happening in the Vineyard. And that whole cool factor is gone now. And so the church adapts, as Brad said, but we adapt based on the basics of Bible and discipleship and the purposes of God and all that. So our adaptations are in one sense tiny compared to that, but they're not unimportant. Because as I often say, if you look at all the conversations that Jesus had with people in the Bible, he always started where they were, not where he wished they were, and he spoke to them on their terms. So the woman at the well, or Zacchaeus, or Nicodemus, or the rich young ruler, the woman caught in adultery, you can just go on and on and on. He always spoke with people on their terms. And that's really what we mean by that fancy missiological term, contextualization. It doesn't mean we're compromising on the eternal verities, to put it in Drucker's terms. We're not compromising on anything. We're simply trying to ask and answer the question, how do we be present to people as they are today?
I think it's so easy to be caught up in this idea about culture wars and battling for certain things. And I think we have to be thoroughly kingdom people. And I think that that has to dictate how we think about ministry within the current context. Because I feel like there's a reactivity to the spirit of the age that's just the church is caught up in. And I think there's a mustard seed slowness to the kingdom that, that gives you some gospel patience and being who God calls you to be.
Well, the other thing that comes to my mind, Mickey, that's a big change in the last 40, whatever it is, 44 years or something since I started my first church, is that like we literally left Southern California, three of us in a Honda Civic, the rest of the car packed out with our belongings, including a guitar. So you can imagine how little was in this little Honda Civic.
Yeah.
Drove to Wheeling. Something had happened along the route from Southern California to Wheeling, West Virginia. And so we had to get a car repair. So we literally showed up into Wheeling with like $60 in our pocket. Mm-hmm. And we thought, man, we don't want to blow our last money on a hotel, but where are we going to stay tonight? So it's too long of a story to tell, but we knew one person in town, literally one person who was going there to be on our team, but she had beat us because she had to enroll for school. So we got there, let's say mid to late September. She'd gotten there early. Mm-hmm. And we didn't know anybody else. So we called her and she asked her roommate, hey, do you know any place where these three guys can stay? And we ended up staying at her friend's mom's house. Well, I tell that anecdote to say that in the late 70s and early 80s, when you were starting a church, you pretty much knew whether you were going to succeed or not within about a year. So it's like no fair to compare me and Debbie at 23 years old, no kids, no financial needs whatsoever. We were like missionaries just having a blast. Now, was there some economic insecurity? Of course, but it lasted about a year, year and a half. And now, obviously, Mickey, I'm old enough to be your and Travis's dad. Now, I think with empathy, because young church planters today have to live with 3 to 5 years of economic insecurity. That's a tall order to ask anybody to do. Sure. And unless, like Brad said, you're seriously grounded in God and the kingdom and like seriously passionately in touch with a call to love a city and bring to bear the goodness and righteousness of God's kingdom to a neighborhood, a city. I mean, that has to be so real because you're looking at bivocational or serious fundraising or whatever for a period of years.
Absolutely.
Well, Todd, you said to us, and when I was in my late 20s, when we went out and planted, we need to start thinking like missionaries and not like pastors first. You have to go into your mission field. You have to learn the language. You have to learn the culture. You invest in people. Well, missionaries don't expect to have instant success. They expect to lay the groundwork for years. And I think that's more true of church planting. There is the one-offs with the super charismatic person who creates a
culture. You spin off 150 people from a mother church or whatever.
But I do think that there's the trajectory is different in planning a church these days, and certainly the expectations. I think a lot of our church plants are in that 2 to 3, 4 year range, and when they're, I think they're doing fantastic, and but they're 125 people, 150 people, robust expressions, but like they're not at 350, they're not at 500. And you hear, you still hear those stories and you get intimidated, like, what are we doing wrong? No, you're doing it right. You're being exactly who you're supposed to be in your context. And it just, you're right, it's a little bit of a slower work.
And I haven't said it to Mickey, and I wish Travis was here, and I probably don't say it enough publicly, but man, I have mad respect for our young church planters.
Yeah.
It's a real deal. I mean, it's a big deal. Because like you said, Brad, you're called to simultaneously be a missionary in that sort of good old-fashioned sense, but building an institution around it, this thing called a parish or a church that has, I'm using the term benignly, if not positively, when I say institution here, a structure, something. You're building a house, a home.
Something out of nothing, where there once was nothing.
Yes, and that adds a dynamic to church planning that's a little different than like a missionary just doing evangelism or something. Again, obviously missionaries are incredibly important, but mad props to all the church planters listening.
Amen to that.
Yeah, it is certainly the hardest work I think we've ever done in our lives, but it is part of why we are so grateful for just the support that we've had especially with Brad. You know, he's our cohort leader, and he's just been a massive resource to us and all the other planters in the cohort as well. So it is, I've said this before, but one of the joys of being a part of this diocese is that we've never felt alone. So that is a comfort, to be sure.
Mutual admiration society going here. So when we talk behind your backs, we talk about how much we respect you guys.
Yeah. Can I just tell you that one of my favorite things is leading that cohort call monthly on Zoom, because I feel so encouraged afterwards. And then I also feel pushed to take more risks.
I feel like,
man, we got to get in the game. These guys are in the game.
That makes sense.
Hey, Alpha Mifflin Quokka is my name.
Saludos, my name is Jonathan Kinberg, and we want to together invite you to our second annual Diaspora Network Conference. Our theme this year is mutuality and mission. What does it look like for immigrants and the broader North American church to really partner together?
The conference will be on July 28th and 29th in Austin, Texas, and it's for immigrants and leaders from C4SO who want to partner with the nations here. See you soon.
So Brad, if somebody's listening to us today and they're having their first little thought of, I don't know, I think maybe I want to plant a church. What's the next thing they do?
Yeah, I'm thinking about the word call, as in call me.
Call Brad.
Let's call him for whatever. If there's an inkling, let's suspect that the Spirit's behind it. Yeah. And let's suspect that, because you're thinking about something fairly audacious. So let's see if we can resource you in trying to figure out what's behind it. Like what's happening, what's God doing in you.
So the next step, if I'm hearing you, is you would work with them, and you and your team, and presumably their rector, to just help them ask the next right questions and tease this out, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would say the one thing that's intrinsic to planning is you have to have a deep sense of call. Yeah, you can't go into it halfway. You have to be all in. You have to really know that God's asked you to do it, because the gut punches will come in the first year, and you have to return to that call. You have to return to that thing. Well, I don't know what we're going to do, but I know God called us here.
Yeah.
So I think call is really important. I think that there has to be a sense of courage, and there has to be something within your context that there's a lots of yeses. Yeah. Like if you're married and the spouse is not on board, you should not plan. It's possible that you could say where our family's at right now, we're not ready to plan. Yeah. But like you have to be really ready to go and dig in and work hard and pray hard. I think those things are really important, a deep sense of your own call. And we'll help work that out with you. And that's why we go through a fairly rigorous assessment process, because sometimes that assessment process yields a not now.
Or you're called to ministry. You have a great calling, but it's just not to church planting.
Yeah,
whatever.
Exactly right. In fact, that's a good result. Mm-hmm. Actually all those results are good ones. We're sensing what God is doing.
Right.
So like assessment, that process of conversation and talking to other people and connecting with people who are planting and then assessing, if we're sensing what the Spirit's doing, should always yield the right result, in the sense that it could be, yes, you're supposed to plant, ministry's great for you, no, this is not the right time. Those are all good results. And I would probably say I've had many where we've concluded together that it wasn't right time to plant, that we've concluded it was the right time to plant in terms of our assessment process. That's what I would say.
And being willing to listen to the wisdom of those who are helping in the discernment process, I think is huge. It's super important.
Really important.
So kind of in that vein, you know, there's no one size fits all to planting. Contextualization looks different in all sorts of areas, but certainly there are things that are definitely not wise or are not effective. What are maybe some of the key findings you've discovered over the last few years of coaching and planting yourself? What are some of the ways that you would caution planters?
So something that back there thinks that we have to be this larger than life type A extrovert entrepreneur to plant a church. And that is not true.
Right.
I think you have to be a leader. I don't think you can cheat on being a leader. There are people all over the spectrum, different gifts mm-hmm. and things. And I've seen the folks who I thought would most likely succeed often, but I've been surprised when they haven't. And folks that I never thought they'd succeed have.
Well, we're back to what you said earlier in the show, that there is definitely a mystery here that we all try to be.
Right.
We try to be as practical and smart and discerning as we can, employing all the right best tools, but there's still a mystery.
Now, I would say when I've seen churches not work, there's a couple things that we've seen. First of all, if again, as I said, that somebody wasn't all in, they had a foot in a different world. Like we sent out a church plant and it failed. Early in the first couple of years of our church plant, we tried it out. But it had to do with the fact that the guy who was going out to plant was dating a girl that was not there and didn't want him to plant. And it was a miserable failure. We thought that she'd come along, but like I wouldn't send out anybody that was in that place again. They need to have that resolved. Do you know what I mean? So I think that teams are more important than ever and core development is more important than ever. So those who are trying to go it alone, or those who are impatient to start too quickly. So like we got a guy in Des Moines right now who is really, he's taken a whole year to lay the groundwork for a launch this fall. Nick and Ashley Knepper have done such great work. Yes. I think they would say they have between 50 and 60 adults are now part of their core for launch this fall. And that took a lot of guts to be that patient, but they moved into the neighborhood and they didn't know anybody. So they had to do that hard work of breaking up the ground. That's going to give them a much greater chance of success because they've kind of tilled the ground and done the hard work of building network and connections and being in people's lives. The other thing I would say is that I hate to be practical, but you have to take money seriously. There is a way in which you have to think about the viability of what has to happen, and it takes some resources.
Right.
So we want people to think that way and not be afraid to think about like, what is it going to really take to get this thing off the ground? And how can I be a part of raising the kind of money? And what are we going to need? So we often are working with our church planners in the pre-launch phase as to how to set themselves up administratively, financially, so that some of the pressure of that is removed in terms of this first 6 months to a year. So
I don't want to make it sound like this whole thing is scary, but I think like the financial aspect was really scary for me and Travis because we were both stepping out of stable jobs. We were both leaving our previous roles at at an established church. And so we had to fundraise for the both of us. And then we were having our son. It was just an immense pressure. But I think what Brad is saying is right is we have to be honest about what the needs are. We need to raise them earnestly so that it frees us up to do the work of ministry and really trusting that the resources will be there. It was hard to believe that because we're looking at the numbers and looking at what it would cost for both of us to step out and do this vocationally. And we were like, this is going to be a lot, but God provides. He always does.
Fundraising can be super intimidating to think about. But the fact of the matter is like I always think to myself, does anybody need another big screen television? No. So why not give them an opportunity to invest in the kingdom? Like if you can get to that place in your mind, then the ask is easy because you're actually asking them to invest in heavenly treasures in some way.
Exactly.
Ways. Once you get your mind over that, then now it becomes something where you're really inviting people to partner with you in something that God's doing. Now you're off and running in terms of thinking about that kind of stuff.
And anybody who's raising money has not read Henry Nouwen's little booklet on, what's it called? The Spirituality of Fundraising or something like that. Ought to read now and because, we all have those moments.
So, Brad, how would an existing church know when it's time to give birth to like a daughter church or even like a plant? How do we kind of center ourselves with this idea of like a church planting being in our DNA? What are the signs to look for? What are the signs of readiness?
Well, first, I'd say just a general ethos, sooner rather than later. There's an old vineyard maxim. John used to say, be prepared to give away your best. There's a kingdom principle there. Like, I think if you're a church of 100, 125, 150, you should already be thinking, dreaming, praying, talking, planning for it. I don't think it's beyond the church of that size. In fact, it's one of our missions for our diocese is to help our churches of 150 start thinking about planting. And every age and culture, right? It's an American anomaly that we're way too are 1,000 strong to plant a church. Like Paul was planting churches of 25 to 30.
Yeah.
And they never, I mean, those congregations were very small when he was planting throughout the Mediterranean. I would say just put it into your DNA to talk, plan, put it in the ethos early, early, and then look for two things. I would say are is God sending you somebody that could be a planter that you could develop? And then also look in your city. Like I've been talking to Austin about the way he views his city in Nashville. And he says, oh, I think I could see his 5-6 churches all ringing Nashville. Yeah. I see neighborhoods.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Like, 'cause again, if you're thinking about parish and you have some people traveling 45 minutes as he does, then you would have to think, well, how could we put a church where they're at? So mm-hmm. they don't have to leave mm-hmm. their neighborhood,
community,
but
yeah.
they stay in their neighborhood, and now they're going to the farmer's market and talking about we're meeting on Sunday and just two blocks away, right? So dreaming, planning, praying, and then just having a vision for your city that's larger than just the church you're planning yourself. And I'd say do that early.
So Brad, you mentioned a few minutes ago about how encouraging your monthly Zoom coaching calls are. Give us a fun story that comes from a recent C4SO plant that brings you joy and you think would bring some joy to our listeners.
I really wish everybody could have been on the Zoom call we had last night. So one person talked about how they were feeling called in Matt Brown in New York City to really care for immigrant populations of Venezuelans mm-hmm. that were being bused mm-hmm. in New York City. One person talked about James, about how they're doing a service at a dog park.
Oh yeah.
For people that come there, they have a church service now for people that go to this dog park locally. One person talked about a pub ministry that they've just started. One person talked about in Silicon Valley, they started an alpha and they had 35 people show up for the first meeting in Silicon Valley. So you think about, we've been welcoming some of our church planters that are planning in immigrant populations. And they talked about the importance of a community meal and how they were dreaming about these barbecues, something I didn't quite even get the context, that something about a horse, the creativity of being on mission and knowing your context and knowing and then trying things. And here's the beauty about being a church plant. I tell people, you keep the tag as long as you can before don't call yourself a church, because church plant gets to fail. They get to try things and fail. Like, oh,
right. it didn't work. Plant. Oh,
we're just bumping around trying to do mission. Right.
Right.
So there's this, we try crazy things as church plant. And last night, the stories were just filled with everybody with energy talking about baptisms and people
so
who were
sense.
Yeah. And then you're like, well, man, if I could have just put that in a bottle and send that to every rector, then mm-hmm. they'll all dream about church planting, because it's so much fun to hear those stories.
No kidding. Now, I want to switch roles with you. You be bishop for a while and I'll coach church planters again.
Yeah. No, thank you.
And this is exactly why I still call C4SO a plant. We're planting a diocese, because we're 10 years in, but I still want to experiment.
It's still,
absolutely.
Claim
it
for
experiment.
As long as you can.
I'll just say one other thing is there are people in their 30s planting and there are people in their 60s planting. And I just think that's really inspiring to think about. Yeah. There's no time when it's too late. And everyone's in the game a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then there's just this cross-pollination where you could just people see, as they're listening to each other's stories on Zoom, they're smiling and they're taking little notes. Oh, pub ministry. I wonder if we could try
that's
that.
That's a great idea. Yeah, it is so good. We look forward to those meetings so much because, first of all, it's fun. We have a really fun group. It is so encouraging to hear all the other planters' stories, what's working for them. They always have suggestions and we help each other out. And we know we can always call on each other. But we also share the challenges. We share the frustrations. It's a really helpful space for us because we're allowed to be very vulnerable and just share hey, here's what we're really struggling with. Can you pray for me? And we spend time praying for one another. I mean, that monthly meeting is really life-giving.
So Brad, if I started a new church at 67, would I be sort of like the Tom Brady of church planting? Tom's doing it at 46 in the NFL. I'm doing it at 67.
Todd, if you're sensing a call, call me.
Call Brad.
Yep, call Brad.
We'll work it out together.
All right. Hey, Mickey, it's been great to be with you today. Brad, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you, Brad.
It's a pleasure being with you guys. This was so much fun.
Thanks so much for tuning in to the C4SO podcast. If you like what you heard, please feel free to share this episode and subscribe and leave a review. It helps us to get the word out. Thanks.